A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to understand the Great Schism, the big one, the original church split between what became the Roman Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy. He's asking how many people belong to each branch today, what relations are like between them, and this is where I think it gets interesting. What actually divides them theologically, beyond the aesthetic stuff people notice, the incense, the icons, the ornamentation. He also wants to know where Orthodoxy is dominant beyond Greece, how the split plays out for Christians in the Middle East and here in Israel, and where groups like the Armenians fit into all this. There's a lot to unpack.
And I love this prompt, because most people know the schism happened. They can picture a Catholic church versus an Orthodox church, but they couldn't tell you why they're still separate 970 years later. The aesthetic difference is the gateway drug, but the theology is where it gets stubborn.
The gateway drug. Herman on church history, everybody.
I'm serious. The incense and the gold leaf are the first thing you notice, and then you start asking questions, and suddenly you're in a debate about the nature of the Trinity and whether the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father alone or from the Father and the Son, and you realize this is not a disagreement about decor.
Let's start with what actually happened. The Great Schism. What year? What was the triggering event?
The traditional date is Deppin 4-4, July 16th specifically. That's when the papal legate, Cardinal Humbert, walked into the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople and laid a bull of excommunication on the altar against the Patriarch of Constantinople, Michael Carularius. And the Patriarch excommunicated the legates right back. It was a mutual excommunication that everyone assumed would get patched up like previous spats. It didn't.
1,000 years of, we'll work it out later, that never got worked out.
And what's fascinating is that 154 wasn't the actual breaking point. It was more like the moment everyone later pointed to and said, that's when it happened. The real rupture took centuries to solidify. The Fourth Crusade in 1204, when Latin crusaders sacked Constantinople, did more damage to relations than any theological dispute ever could. You had Western Christians looting Eastern Christian churches, stealing relics, installing a Latin patriarch. That's not something you patch up with a joint statement.
The theology provided the justification, but the politics and the bloodshed made it permanent.
The theology was accumulating for centuries before 154. The big ones are the Filioque. That's the clause in the Nicene Creed about the Holy Spirit proceeding from the Father and the Son, which the Western Church added unilaterally. Papal supremacy, the use of unleavened bread in the Eucharist, clerical celibacy, purgatory, the Immaculate Conception. But here's the thing, the Filioque was the hill they chose to die on.
Break down the Filioque. What's actually at stake?
The original Nicene Creed, as agreed at the ecumenical councils, said the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. In the 6th century, the Western Church, starting in Spain, began adding the word Filioque and the Son to the creed. So now, the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. The Eastern Church said, you don't get to change the creed unilaterally. This was the foundational statement of Christian belief, agreed by councils representing the whole church, and you're adding words without asking us.
Which to the east looked like a power move dressed up as theology.
And from the Eastern perspective, it also messes with the Trinity. If the Father is the sole source of the Spirit, the Father has a unique role. If the Son also sends forth the Spirit, you're blurring the distinctiveness of the persons. The West said no, this protects the full divinity of the Son. If the Son doesn't send the Spirit, you're demoting him. Both sides thought the other was undermining the Trinity.
It's not a minor wording tweak. It's about who God is. That's harder to finesse.
It gets compounded by papal supremacy. The Eastern Church had a collegial model. The patriarchs of Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem were equals, first among equals at most. The Bishop of Rome was honored but didn't have jurisdiction over the others. The Western Church, over centuries, developed the doctrine that the Pope has universal and immediate jurisdiction over the entire Church and is infallible when speaking ex cathedra on matters of faith and morals. That was formalized at the First Vatican Council in 1870, but the idea had been building for 1,000 years.
The East never bought it.
To this day, the Orthodox understanding is that the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, first in honor, but not a monarch. They'll say the Church is conciliar, not monarchical. So you have two fundamentally different models of Church authority, and neither side can change without admitting they were wrong for centuries.
Which brings us to the numbers. How many people are we actually talking about today?
The Catholic Church is the largest Christian communion by a wide margin. About 1.39 billion baptized members globally as of the most recent Vatican statistics. That's more than half of all Christians. Eastern Orthodoxy is the second largest single communion, at roughly 220 to 260 million depending on how you count. The most commonly cited figure is around 220 million, so we're talking about a ratio of roughly 6 to 1.
Still, 220 million is not small. That's the population of a large country.
It's enormous, and it's concentrated in specific regions. Russia is the big one. The Russian Orthodox Church alone accounts for more than half of all Orthodox Christians, maybe 150 million. Then you have Ukraine, Romania, Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, Belarus, Georgia, Moldova, North Macedonia, Montenegro, Cyprus. Those are the countries where Orthodoxy is either the majority religion or the dominant Christian tradition.
I know people sometimes confuse Ethiopian Christianity with Orthodoxy.
The Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church is part of the Oriental Orthodox Communion, not Eastern Orthodox. This is a separate split that happened earlier, in 451, at the Council of Chalcedon. The Oriental Orthodox Churches, Armenian, Coptic, Ethiopian, Eritrean, Syriac, Malankara, Indian. They rejected the Chalcedonian definition that Christ has two natures, divine and human, in one person. They hold to what's called miaphysitism, one nature that is both divine and human. The Eastern Orthodox and Catholics accept Chalcedon. So you have two entirely separate Orthodox communions, Eastern Orthodox, which split from Rome in 1054, and Oriental Orthodox, which split from the rest of the Imperial Church in 451.
When Daniel asks where Armenians fall, they're Oriental Orthodox, not Eastern Orthodox.
The Armenian Apostolic Church is one of the oldest Christian traditions in the world, founded in the early 4th century. Armenia was the first nation to adopt Christianity as a state religion, around 31 AD. They're not in communion with either Rome or Constantinople, and that's important for understanding the Christian landscape in the Middle East.
Let's go there. The prompt asks specifically about Christians in the Middle East and here in Israel. What's the breakdown?
The Christian presence in the Middle East is ancient and fragmented in ways that reflect all these historical schisms. In Israel and the Palestinian territories, Christians are a small minority, about 2% of the population in Israel proper, maybe 1-2% in the West Bank and Gaza. But within that small community, you have an extraordinary diversity of denominations. The Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem is the largest Christian denomination in the Holy Land. That's Eastern Orthodox. Then you have the Latin Patriarchate, which is Roman Catholic. You have the Melkite Greek Catholic Church, which is an Eastern Catholic Church. They use the Byzantine Rite, but are in communion with Rome. You have Maronites, Armenian Orthodox, Armenian Catholic, Syriac Orthodox, Syriac Catholic, Coptic Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox, Anglicans, Lutherans, various evangelical groups. It's a microcosm of every schism in church history, all living in a very small geographical area.
The Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem. That's the group that's been here since the Byzantine period?
Since the 4th century. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is jointly managed by several denominations under what's called the status quo, an arrangement formalized by the Ottoman Sultan in 1852 and 1853. The primary custodians are the Greek Orthodox, the Armenian Apostolic, and the Roman Catholic, specifically the Franciscan custody of the Holy Land. Then the Coptic, Syriac, and Ethiopian Orthodox have secondary rights. It's an incredibly complex arrangement where every square meter of the church is allocated to a specific denomination, and changing anything requires unanimous consent.
Which is why a ladder has been sitting on a ledge above the entrance since the 1800s.
The immovable ladder. It's been there since at least the 1750s, under the status quo, because no one can agree who has the right to move it. It's the perfect symbol of frozen inter-church relations. Nobody can touch the ladder without triggering a crisis, so the ladder stays.
The ladder is my favorite ecumenical metaphor.
It's perfect. And it gets at something real about relations between these churches. On the ground in Jerusalem, the various patriarchates and custodies coexist. They have working relationships. The priests know each other. But there are periodic flare-ups. In 2002, there was a physical altercation between Franciscan and Ethiopian Orthodox monks over a rooftop monastery at the Holy Sepulchre. In 2008, Greek Orthodox and Armenian priests brawled during the Feast of the Cross. These aren't theological disputes. They're territorial disputes in a zero-sum sacred space.
The theology created the divisions, but now they're maintained by property, precedent, and institutional inertia.
That's the thing about the Middle East. Christian identity here is deeply tied to specific church traditions. You're not just a Christian, you're a Greek Orthodox Christian or a Maronite or an Armenian. These identities are ethnic and linguistic as much as religious. The liturgy is in Greek or Arabic or Armenian or Syriac. The community's history is bound up in the patriarchate.
Which makes ecumenical dialogue at the global level feel somewhat disconnected from the lived reality in places like Jerusalem. The theologians can agree on documents, but the ladder doesn't move.
Yet there's been real progress at the theological level. The mutual excommunications of 1054 were lifted in 1965 by Pope Paul VI and Patriarch Athenagoras of Constantinople. That was huge. It didn't restore communion, but it formally ended the state of schism as a personal anathema. Since then, there's been an ongoing international theological dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. They produced several agreed statements.
What do they actually agree on now?
The big one is the Ravenna document from 2007. It acknowledged that the Bishop of Rome has a primacy, a special role. But the two sides disagree on what that primacy means in practice. The Orthodox said primacy at the universal level must be exercised in a conciliar way, not monarchically. So they agreed the Pope has primacy, but they didn't agree on jurisdiction or infallibility. It was a breakthrough in acknowledging the Pope isn't just first among equals in a purely honorary sense. There's something substantive there. But they're still far apart on what that substance is.
They agreed there's a chair, but not what sitting in it means.
More recently, in 2016, Pope Francis and Patriarch Kirill of Moscow met in Havana, the first meeting between a pope and a Russian Orthodox patriarch in history. They issued a joint declaration that focused mostly on the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and the defense of traditional Christian values. It was more geopolitical than theological.
Since then, the Russia-Ukraine war has probably made things worse.
The Orthodox world is deeply divided over Ukraine. In 2019, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, granted autocephaly, independence, to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which had been under the Moscow Patriarchate. Moscow severed communion with Constantinople in response. So you now have a schism within Orthodoxy itself, with the Russian Orthodox Church not in communion with Constantinople and other Orthodox churches taking sides or trying to mediate. The Catholic Church has tried to stay neutral, but Pope Francis has met with Ukrainian Greek Catholic leaders and has been careful not to alienate Moscow either. It's a diplomatic tightrope.
The Catholic-Orthodox dialogue is already complicated, and then Orthodoxy has its own internal schism happening simultaneously.
That internal schism is partly about the same issue that caused the Great Schism, who has authority. The Ecumenical Patriarch claims a special role as first among equals, including the right to grant autocephaly. Moscow says no, you don't have that right unilaterally.
Everybody wants to be first among equals, until someone else claims it.
And it's not lost on anyone in the ecumenical world that the Orthodox churches, which split from Rome partly over papal authority, are now having their own version of the same fight.
Let's talk about the theological differences, beyond the filioque and papal supremacy. What else actually divides these traditions?
Purgatory is a big one. The Catholic Church teaches that after death, souls that are saved but not yet fully purified undergo a process of purification, purgatory, before entering heaven. The Orthodox Church rejects this. They believe in an intermediate state, but they don't define it as a place of temporal punishment or purification by fire the way the Latin tradition did. It's more of a waiting state, and they're comfortable leaving it mysterious in a way the Catholic tradition, with its impulse to define everything, is not.
The Catholic impulse to define everything is a whole theological aesthetic in itself.
It really is. The Immaculate Conception is another difference. The Catholic Church defined as dogma in 1854 that Mary was conceived without original sin. The Orthodox don't accept this. Not because they think Mary was sinful. They have an enormous devotion to the Theotokos, the God-bearer, but they don't accept the Western understanding of original sin as inherited guilt. The Eastern view is more that we inherit the consequences of the fall, mortality, and the inclination to sin, but not the guilt of Adam's sin. So the Immaculate Conception solves a problem the Orthodox never had.
That's a fascinating distinction. Same words, different conceptual frameworks underneath.
That's true across so many of these disputes. The filioque makes sense if you start from Augustine's understanding of the Trinity, which the West did. It doesn't make sense if you start from the Cappadocian Fathers, which the East did. The Immaculate Conception makes sense if you believe in inherited guilt. It doesn't if you don't. Purgatory makes sense if you have a legal, satisfaction-based understanding of atonement. It doesn't if you have a more therapeutic, transformative understanding of salvation.
The schism isn't just a list of disagreements. It's two different theological languages that diverged over centuries.
They diverged partly because the East and West stopped reading each other's theologians. After the fall of the Western Roman Empire, Greek largely disappeared in the West. Latin largely disappeared in the East. Augustine, who shaped Western theology more than anyone except Paul, was barely read in the East for centuries. The Eastern Fathers, Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory Nazianzen, Maximus the Confessor, were barely known in the West. The two halves of the Church developed in parallel, with different intellectual frameworks, different liturgical languages, different spiritualities.
The incense and the icons are just the surface of a much deeper divergence in how you even think about God.
The spirituality really is different. The Eastern tradition is deeply apophatic. It emphasizes that God is beyond all concepts, all images, all words. You approach God by negation, by saying what God is not. The Western tradition, especially after Thomas Aquinas, is more cataphatic. It uses analogy and positive statements about God while acknowledging their limitations. Neither is wrong, but they produce very different spiritual climates.
The East says God is a mystery you enter into. The West says God is a doctrine you can, with care, say true things about.
That's a simplification, but not a distortion. And it shows up in the liturgy. The Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which is the standard Orthodox service, is meant to be an experience of heaven on earth. The iconostasis, the wall of icons separating the nave from the sanctuary, isn't a barrier, it's a window. It reveals the heavenly reality that's present, but hidden. The incense, the chant, the lack of instrumental music, the standing for the entire service, it's all designed to pull you into a transfigured reality.
Versus the Latin Mass, which in its traditional form has its own kind of transcendent logic. The silence, the precision, the sacrificial focus.
This is where the aesthetic question in the prompt connects to theology. The ornamentation in Orthodoxy isn't decoration. Icons are theology in color. They're not paintings of religious subjects. They're windows into the transfigured reality of the person depicted. The Seventh Ecumenical Council in 787 defined that the honor given to the icon passes to its prototype, so you're not worshiping wood and paint, you're venerating the person depicted. That distinction between worship, latria, and veneration, dulia, is fundamental.
The Catholic tradition has its own rich visual culture, but the Orthodox tradition made the icon central in a way that's qualitatively different.
Because the icon is tied to the incarnation. The argument is, God became visible in Christ, therefore it's legitimate to depict Christ. If you reject icons, you're implicitly denying the full reality of the incarnation. That was the argument that won at the Seventh Ecumenical Council, ending the iconoclast controversy. The icon is a confession of faith, not a decoration.
Which is why you'll see Orthodox Christians kissing icons when they enter a church. It's not sentimentality, it's a theological act.
And this connects to another difference, the Orthodox understanding of theosis, divinization. The goal of the Christian life, in the Eastern understanding, is to become by grace what God is by nature, to participate in the divine nature, as 2 Peter says. The whole apparatus of Orthodox spirituality, the fasting, the liturgy, the icons, the Jesus prayer, the monastic tradition of Mount Athos, is oriented toward transformation, toward union with God. The Western tradition has this too, but it's less central in popular piety, which tends to focus more on moral transformation and the avoidance of sin.
The Eastern tradition is more ambitious about what the human person can become.
I'd say it's more explicit about the ultimate goal. Both traditions agree that the end is union with God. The East just talks about it more directly and builds the whole spiritual life around it.
Let's circle back to the Middle East. You mentioned the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem is the largest Christian denomination here. But what's the actual lived experience of these divisions for Christians on the ground?
It varies enormously. For an Arab Christian in Nazareth or Bethlehem, being Greek Orthodox is often more about ethnic and communal identity than about theological distinctives. The liturgy is in Arabic in many parishes, though some Greek remains. The clergy are mostly local Arabs, though the upper hierarchy of the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate has historically been dominated by ethnic Greeks, which has been a source of tension for decades.
The congregation is Arab. The bishops are Greek.
That's been the pattern, though it's slowly changing. There have been Arab bishops consecrated in recent decades, but the patriarch is always Greek, and that's been a point of friction. The laity has periodically protested, demanding more Arab representation in the hierarchy and more transparency in church finances, especially around land sales. The Greek Orthodox Patriarchate is one of the largest private landowners in Israel and the Palestinian territories. It owns significant properties in Jerusalem, Jaffa, Nazareth, and elsewhere. Over the years, there have been controversial sales and long-term leases of church land to Israeli entities, which have angered the local Arab Christian community, who see it as selling off Palestinian heritage. It's a whole political dimension layered on top of the ecclesiastical structure.
The church is both a spiritual institution and a major property holder, and those roles conflict.
As they do everywhere. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself is a real estate arrangement as much as a holy site. The status quo I mentioned isn't a theological document. It's a property management agreement enforced by civil authorities, originally the Ottomans, now the Israeli government, the Palestinian Authority, and the Jordanian monarchy, which has a special role regarding the Christian holy sites.
What about the other Middle Eastern churches? You mentioned the Maronites.
The Maronite church is fascinating. They're an Eastern Catholic church. They use a Syriac Antiochene liturgy. They have their own patriarch, their own canon law, married priests, but they're in full communion with Rome. They've been in communion with Rome continuously since the 12th century, which makes them one of the oldest Eastern Catholic churches. They're centered in Lebanon, where they're the largest Christian group and have significant political power. The Lebanese constitution reserves the presidency for a Maronite.
They're a bridge tradition in a way. Eastern liturgy, Western allegiance.
That's been controversial. Some Orthodox see the Eastern Catholic churches as a kind of ecclesiastical poaching, Rome creating parallel hierarchies in Orthodox territories. The term uniate is sometimes used pejoratively. The Orthodox say, you took our liturgy, our spirituality, our married priesthood, and you submitted it to the Pope. It's a wound that hasn't fully healed.
From the Catholic perspective, these churches chose unity with Rome while preserving their traditions.
That's the Catholic argument. This is what unity looks like, diversity and communion with the successor of Peter. The Orthodox counter that it's not unity, it's absorption dressed up as diversity, and this debate is very much alive. When the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, another Eastern Catholic Church, was re-established after the fall of the Soviet Union, it reclaimed church properties that had been transferred to the Orthodox during the Soviet era. That led to violent clashes in the 1990s.
The theology is the official reason for the division, but property, ethnicity, and politics keep it frozen.
Frozen is the right word. The Catholic and Orthodox churches have been in dialogue for decades, and they've made real progress on paper. But paper agreements don't restore communion. Full communion would require resolving papal authority, and that's not a theological nuance. It's a structural question about how the church is governed. If the Pope has universal jurisdiction, the Orthodox would have to accept that. If he doesn't, the Catholic Church would have to walk back a defined dogma. Neither side can do that easily.
Is there any scenario where they'd just agree to disagree? We'll be in communion. You run your house your way. We'll run ours ours.
That's essentially the Eastern Catholic model, and the Orthodox have rejected it as a template for full unity. They don't want to be Eastern Catholic. They want the Catholic Church to renounce what they see as overreach. The Catholic position is that unity isn't just agreeing to coexist, it's being in full sacramental communion under a single visible head.
Which sounds to Orthodox ears like submit to Rome.
That's the core of it. Until that's resolved, everything else is window dressing.
What about the Armenians in all this? The prompt specifically asks about them.
The Armenians are in a unique position. The Armenian Apostolic Church is Oriental Orthodox, so they're not in communion with either Rome or the Eastern Orthodox, but they have a very strong presence in Jerusalem. The Armenian Quarter of the Old City is one of the four quarters, and the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem has been there since the 4th century. They're one of the three major custodians of the Holy Sepulchre, alongside the Greeks and the Latins.
Their tradition is distinct. Their own language, their own liturgy, their own history.
Classical Armenian, Grabar, is their liturgical language. Their rite is the Armenian rite. They have their own calendar. They celebrate Christmas on January 6th, like the Armenians in Armenia itself. And they've maintained this distinct identity through centuries of Islamic rule, Crusader kingdoms, Ottoman rule, the British Mandate, and now Israeli control. It's a remarkable story of institutional survival.
In terms of theology, they're Miaphysite, you said. One nature of Christ.
The Armenian Church, along with the Coptic, Syriac, Ethiopian, Eritrean, and Malankara Orthodox churches, holds that Christ has one nature that is both divine and human, without separation, without confusion. The Chalcedonian churches, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and most Protestant, hold that Christ has two natures, divine and human, in one person. The Oriental Orthodox say this sounds like dividing Christ. The Chalcedonians say the Miaphysite position sounds like mixing the natures, and for 1500 years they've been separated over this.
There have been attempts to bridge that gap too.
Major breakthroughs, actually. In the 1980s and 1990s, theological dialogues between the Oriental Orthodox and the Eastern Orthodox produced agreed statements that essentially said, we were saying the same thing in different words. The Oriental Orthodox said, one nature, meaning one composite nature, not one simple nature, not a mixture, not an absorption. The Chalcedonian said, two natures, meaning distinct, but never separate. The agreed conclusion was that both families are within the bounds of Orthodoxy, and the schism was more about terminology and politics than substance.
451 was a misunderstanding that took 15 centuries to clear up.
But the same institutional inertia applies. Even if the theologians agree, restoring communion requires the churches to reorganize overlapping jurisdictions, resolve property claims, deal with centuries of separate development. The Eastern Orthodox and Oriental Orthodox haven't restored communion yet, even though the theological dialogue was largely successful. The Coptic and Greek Orthodox Patriarchates of Alexandria are in a particularly warm relationship. They've made pastoral agreements about mixed marriages and shared use of churches. But full communion is still pending.
You have three major Christian communions, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Oriental Orthodox, all separated from each other, all with active dialogues, none having achieved full reunion.
That's just the ancient churches. Once you add Protestantism, the fragmentation gets even more complex. But the three ancient communions are the ones that trace their origins to the undivided church of the first millennium, and their divisions are the deepest and most historically rooted.
Let's zoom out for a moment. The prompt asks about relations today. What's the temperature?
At the highest level, warm but stuck. Pope Francis has an excellent personal relationship with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew. They've met many times. They've issued joint statements on environmental issues, on migration, on the Middle East. Francis has referred to the Orthodox as sister churches and has spoken of a reconciled diversity. Bartholomew attended Francis's inauguration in 2013, the first time an ecumenical patriarch attended a papal inauguration since the schism.
That's genuinely significant.
And there have been gestures that matter. Pope Francis returned relics to the Orthodox, bone fragments of St. Peter that had been in the Vatican, which he gave to Bartholomew. John Paul II returned the relics of St. John Chrysostom and St. John Chrysostom, Gregory Nazianzen, to Constantinople in 2004. These are symbolic acts, but in traditions that take relics seriously, they're not just photo ops.
Then Moscow breaks communion with Constantinople, and the whole thing gets more complicated.
The Orthodox world isn't a monolith, and that's part of the challenge for Catholic Orthodox dialogue. When the Pope meets with the Ecumenical Patriarch, Moscow says he doesn't speak for us, and Moscow is half of Orthodoxy. So any progress with Constantinople is only partial progress, and any tension with Moscow affects the whole dynamic.
Is there a realistic path to full communion?
Not in our lifetimes, probably. Not because of ill will, but because the structural issues are hard. The Catholic Church can't unilaterally redefine papal primacy without undermining its own self-understanding. The Orthodox can't accept papal jurisdiction without undermining theirs. The most realistic near-term goal is what they call intercommunion in exceptional circumstances, allowing Catholics and Orthodox to receive communion in each other's churches in specific pastoral situations. That already happens in some places in the Middle East, where Christians are a small minority, and the practical need for solidarity outweighs the canonical barriers.
Which brings us back to the Middle East. In a place where Christians are 2% of the population, these divisions look different.
They look like a luxury you can't afford. When you're a tiny minority, the difference between Greek Orthodox and Melkite Catholic matters less than the fact that you're both Christian. There's a lot of informal cooperation. In many villages in Galilee, you'll find Orthodox and Catholic families intermarried, attending each other's feasts, sharing community life. The hierarchy maintains the canonical boundaries, but the people on the ground often blur them.
In Jerusalem specifically, the churches cooperate on the status quo arrangements because they have to.
The status quo is a forced cooperation. It's not warm, but it works. The various communities know exactly what their rights are, down to the minute. Who processes where, at what time, with how many candles. The Israeli police are sometimes involved in enforcing it. During Holy Week, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is a choreography of competing jurisdictions that somehow, most years, manages to function.
A choreography of competing jurisdictions. That's the whole history of the Church in one phrase.
The ladder is still there.
The ladder is still there.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, researchers in the Caspian Basin measured the tensile strength of spider silk from a local orb weaver species and found it could support a weight of over 350 kilograms per square millimeter, comparable to the yield strength of the steel cables used to build the Golden Gate Bridge, but at 1/6 the density.
The Caspian had spiders that could theoretically suspend a suspension bridge.
I'm now going to think about that every time I see a spiderweb.
So to wrap this up, the Great Schism is not one thing. It's layers of theology, language, culture, politics, and property that accumulated over centuries and hardened into separate identities. The divisions are real, and they're maintained by genuine theological disagreements, but also by the sheer weight of institutional history. And yet, the dialogue continues, the gestures keep happening, and on the ground, especially in places like the Middle East, Christians find ways to live and worship side by side, even when their hierarchies can't sort out the theology.
The question that hangs over all of it is whether the Church can ever recover a model of unity that isn't just one side absorbing the other. The first millennium had something. A communion of churches with different rites, different languages, different theological emphases, all recognizing each other as fully church. Recovering something like that, without papering over the real differences that developed in the second millennium, is the project. It's slow. But the fact that the dialogue is still happening 970 years after Humbert laid that bull on the altar says something.
It says Christians are very patient.
Or very stubborn.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show happen. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review. It helps.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu, it's so-
thing odd is in your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear hoes. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.